This show is brought to you by MTN. For your everyday moves, try this new MTN app. MTN, SA's best network.
I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is the Tech Central Show, which is brought to you today by MTN Business. Visit www.mtnbusiness.co.za to learn more about their products and services. And we thank them for partnering with Tech Central to bring you these great interviews. My guest in the Tech Central studio in Johannesburg today is Alpheus Mangale, CEO of Seacom, the company that built, I think, the first submarine cable system along Africa's east coast. The company has just announced last week that it is building a new cable system that will have a design capacity of, wait for it, 2,000 terabits per second. That's enough terabits to make my head spin, Alpheus. This is, in fact, going to be one of the highest capacity submarine cable systems ever built on planet Earth. Please take me through the technology you're deploying and how on earth are you getting to 2,000 terabits per second of design capacity?
Duncan, first and foremost, thank you for having me. It's been a while, actually.
It has been a while.
It's been a while. Thank you for having us here, and I'm really privileged to be here with you.
My pleasure.
I guess more privileged, before I answer your question, more privileged to be at the helm of Seacom, as we almost kind of define the future of communications. I mean, that's really, really a real privilege. I lead a team of passionate people across 12 of our markets in Africa and the rest of the world that wake up every morning that make sure that connectivity that connects this continent and the rest of the world work. And I think to be at the helm at this stage, to be talking about the next frontier of communication in the area that we operate in, it's really, really exciting for me.
How long have you been planning Seacom 2.0?
It's been in the cards for the last 18 months. Mm-hmm. We started actually doing physical work related to the cable over the last 12 months. And I have to actually, maybe it's a good time to mention this. I have to thank our partner, the Department of International Cooperation and DECO.
Oh, yes.
Right. I mean, they've been an instrumental partner to us over the last 24 months, enabling kind of engagements with different countries that we're going to be landing in. And if it wasn't for them, quite frankly, we'll probably be slightly behind the schedule that we've got. So I have to thank them. I think They've been really, really great.
Mm. Right. Let's talk about the tech.
Yep.
2,000 terabits a second. That's 2 petabytes?
Yeah.
Petabits per second, I think it is. How do you get to such a high capacity? I know there have been huge advances in optical fiber technology in recent years, but even that seems like a huge leap forward.
No, absolutely. I mean, just go back. I mean, it sounds like it's yesterday. If you go back 2009, when we launched the first subsea cable on the east coast of the continent, that was 16 years ago. Mm-hmm. At that point,
I remember it.
You remember that very well, right?
With Brian Herlihy.
With Brian Herlihy, Andile Ngawa, everybody else. I mean, one of the things that I should mention today, I'm quite fortunate that all of those individuals are still involved in the business. So mm-hmm. I can still kind of tap onto their experience and knowledge that they've gathered for over many, many years. And I think that doesn't come very, very easily. So I'm quite fortunate to have their access today. So just go back then. 2009, when we deployed our cable, we had, I mean, the cable capacity then was roughly about maybe 2, 3, 4 fiber pairs. Mm-hmm. We got today up to about 35 terabits per second that connect Africa today on our cable.
That's on the one that was deployed in 2009,
correct. Okay. Yeah, so obviously connecting. Yeah.
That's because the technology has advanced in the years. It's allowed you to increase the capacity of the system.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So over the last 16 years, the technology in the subsea capacity has increased. I mean, if you look at the cables that have been deployed today, would be either 16 pairs, would be 24 pairs. I know the new cables that have been deployed today are 24 pairs. We're thinking of deploying, in fact, we're planning on deploying a 48-core pair cable, which...
Has that been done anywhere yet?
At this stage, no. They've not been done anywhere. There's been trial tests. There's been tests that have been done by various other players. In fact, I think you're probably going to get the first cables that will probably go into production probably sometime early next year. Mm-hmm. We may be one of the early adopters of that technology in this area. But I think maybe prior us, I think there might be other people that will do that. Definitely the hyperscalers are likely to deploy that technology before we do. So given just the advancement of technology, I think you might recall this, the optical technology started with TDM, mm-hmm. time division multiplexing. Yeah. Then you went to WDM, right, which was wavelengths. In fact, our cable that we have today, it's based on WDM, right? The new technology is SDM, mm-hmm. spatial division multiplexing. Oh. Basically, what, in a very simple terms, if you go back to the WDM technology, you would have on one single fiber line, you would actually have, I mean, the best analogy to look at it, you would actually have, you put more cars on one fiber, but those cars will be represented by different colors. Mm. Right? That's why you've got wavelengths as different colors. Then in this SDM technology, you effectively, you have multiple lanes that allows you to even put more multiple lanes on that. So now you can put 24 fiber pairs on one, and each of those fiber pairs, you can then run individual wavelengths. Mm-hmm. And a wavelength, you can get technology today, or per wavelength, you can get up to 1.6 terabytes. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason why you get to that unprecedented amount of capacity that we're going to have.
That's amazing. 48 fiber pairs, 2,000 terabits per second. Where's all this demand going to come from?
Actually, it's quite interesting. We've been doing some research. It's actually very well-known stats. If you look at the global internet traffic over the last 4 years, since 2020 to 2024, you look at the global internet traffic, it's probably more than doubled. Mm-hmm. Today, you're sitting at 2020, you're sitting at about 32 octabytes of traffic. Today, you're sitting at about 68. And that's happened over the last 4 years. Just not even thinking about AI. When you talk about AI, the amount of bandwidth that's going to be leveraged by actually using AI technology is going to be unprecedented. So you might argue that we are betting on AI, and mm-hmm. absolutely right. In fact, AI is going to change the way the internet connectivity works today. I mean, you probably saw in our press release, we estimate there are going to be more than 10 billion agents globally. And these are agents AI agents that you and I are going to use without realizing we're using them. Mm-hmm. That effectively talking to LLMs, going to fetch more data, increasing the LLM capabilities and going back to fetch. All of this is going to change. And all of that is going to generate a number of demands for bandwidth across the continent mm-hmm. and the world. And more so, I would say, if we just come back into our continent, Africa, were you sitting with bandwidth growth in some of the markets today, like in Tanzania, international bandwidth is growing by 40%. In Kenya, 32%. In South Africa, it's about 20%. Also, if you go to the other part of the Indian Ocean, you're also seeing the same stats of bandwidth utilization going up. In fact, I would argue Africa today, according to stats, we are roughly about, our bandwidth growth in Africa is about 41% compared to the world, whereas the world is growing at 24%. So mm-hmm. it is quite opportune for us to be deploying this infrastructure, not only to cater for the current bandwidth utilization and the increase that's happening, but to really future-proof the region for AI readiness and all of that.
There's been a lot of investment over the last few years in submarine infrastructure around the African continent. Mm. We know Google has invested in the Equiano cable, they've just announced the Omoja cable. They're also involved in terrestrial infrastructure. Of course, Meta has announced, or they are in the process of building, the Two Africa cable, which circumnavigates the entire continent. And there are other cable systems that have been deployed by major telecommunications operators. Is there a risk that the market is becoming overtraded, like we saw in the North Atlantic in around the dot-com time in the early 2000s? There was a huge investment in undersea cables between Europe and the United States. Is there a bit of a land grab going on now around Africa? And is there a risk that some investors might get their fingers burned?
Mm. No, I think, are there going to be mistakes made by people? I think there would be. I mean, I always say with any technology advancement and all of that, some people might get it wrong, other people get it right. But by and large, I think a lot of people get it right. My view, and also the view of SICOM, it's quite straightforward, is we do not have enough connectivity to drive the current and the future bandwidth demands that we're going to have. Very simply put, I think you're absolutely right. There's been a number of undersea cables that have been kind of circling the whole continent today, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there's you mentioned the Equiano to Africa, our cable as well. Mm-hmm. But what also needs to happen is to take the cable capacity that terminates at the cable landing stations to the cities and the metros.
Yes.
Today, majority of African people remain unconnected meaningfully. When I say meaningfully, the connectivity that you and I enjoy, for instance, where you can get about 100 megabit per second or even 1 gig per second from your home, mm-hmm. majority of Africans don't have that connectivity. So if you think about it, today, demand for bandwidth is generated by only a fraction of people that are connected in the continent. Imagine a world where everybody is now connected meaningfully. where people can now generate videos, share videos with one another and all of that. I mean, it was only probably about 2 decades ago when we started talking about video. We said video is going to be the mode of communication. During those days, it was data. Mm-hmm. So it was voice. Sorry, I beg your pardon. But today's video. People prefer video than actually a phone call and all of that. At that point, we thought we had enough bandwidth and everything else. But today, we actually depleted all of that. So the future, in my view, is going to require a lot more bandwidth, not only terrestrial subsea, mm-hmm. and also if you then superimpose on top of that, the traffic that's going to be generated by AI. I was actually reading a stat now from one of the companies. I obviously won't mention the name of the company. Is they're saying just between 2024 and 2025, traffic growth from you and I and from users to AI-generated services has grown 251%. Mm. So imagine when everybody's using AI. I mean, the traffic in other companies are even arguing that traffic alone has grown over 500% in the US and all of that. Mm-hmm. So a world where it's powered by AI, it's definitely going to require more bandwidth. Inferencing is going to require more bandwidth. AI agents are going to require more bandwidth. We now have AI talk to through their own protocols called Model Context Protocol. That protocol alone, just to talk to billions of agents, is going to create more bandwidth that's required on the internet. So I think the capacity cannot be enough, in my view.
You mentioned the need for more terrestrial infrastructure. As part of the CECOM 2.0 plan, maybe talk us through a little bit about what you're going to be doing on land. I presume this is going to involve the deployment of new landing stations, or will you be retrofitting your existing landing stations? Just talk us through what that landing infrastructure is going to look like and how that's then going to feed into terrestrial fiber networks around the continent.
A great question, by the way, Duncan. In fact, you're going to have to, we are reimagining cable landing stations. In fact, I was talking to our CTO earlier today, mm-hmm. and I was saying to him that I think we should probably not call cable landing stations anymore, because they are going to be nodes, intelligent nodes that are going to do a lot more than just landing a cable. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you think about in 2009 when we landed our cable at that point, it was the cable landing station. All we needed there was power, some racks to put in what we call submarine termination equipment.
Yes.
And then you light up the fiber and then you then connect to the main cities. But now going forward with AI coming online, you now have to reimagine the cable landing stations to become like edge data centers. Mm-hmm. So we can deploy GPUs. Certainly we're thinking of deploying GPUs at those edge data centers.
Okay.
Make sure there's enough power that come in and actually be able to do some processing without having to go to the main cities. Mm-hmm. So therefore it also reduces the bandwidth requirement from the cable landing station to the cities. You can now do distributed computing, distributed processing and all of that. So today our landing cable landing stations provide basic capability, but the future is definitely as part of CECOM 2.0. We are actually thinking of cable landing stations in a very different way. In fact, I see a world where you not only have cable landing at the station, but you also have what I call the receiver units of satellites. They will be closely located next to the cable landing stations, because from there, you can pick up any communication, any data to through terrestrial networks and also to the rest of the world. So I think if you looked at cable landing stations like before, I think you're going to have to think very differently now because of the technology and everything that can be done there.
So I presume you'll be using some of your existing landing stations and retrofitting those, but this cable's also following a little bit of a different route to last time. In fact, it's a bigger system than it was before, and there's a new leg that's proposed to run across the Indian Ocean, and you're also going to run a leg from the north coast of KwaZulu-Natal, where your existing landing station is, around the Cape and up to Angola.
Correct.
So that's going to require new landing station infrastructure. Have you decided yet where exactly you're going to place these landing stations and edge data centers? Maybe give us a bit of detail about what you're planning.
Absolutely. So I mean, we have a bit of an advantage here because we know the terrain very well. Mm-hmm. So we are going to definitely land in the countries that we are today. Mm-hmm. We're also connecting countries that we didn't connect on the first cable. Some of the countries that I've visited over the last 12 months, for instance, some of them are not even connected to the internet. So CECOM landing there for the first time.
Such as?
Like Eritrea, for instance. We will be in, I'll come back to that point now, just to talk about that. I was actually in Eritrea about 2 months ago, as an example. So those countries today that do not even connect to the world are now going to actually either transit or connect to the world. And it's really up to the Eritreans to decide as to whether they want to connect and the country to the rest of the world. So we're definitely going to leverage existing cable landing stations. We're going to be building new. And we're going to do this in partnership with other players. For instance, in my recent visit to all of these countries, there are telcos that operate in those countries. In other countries, they actually would help us land the cable. We'll land then and they'll manage the cable on our behalf. Mm-hmm. Other countries will actually have to build our own new, completely new landing stations together with a mini data center to do that. So I would say probably it's going to be a combination of different models. Build our own where we don't have, retrofit the ones that we currently have in those countries that we're going to land in, that we currently land today, and also land with other partners in markets where it doesn't make sense to don't go and build another landing cable landing station. And like, for instance, in Europe and certainly in Saudi Arabia and also other markets, they have got this concept of kind of call it open access cable landing station, where you can have four or five cables coming into the game, the same landing position. So we'll be leveraging a number of that capability as well.
And that's where Derco, I presume, has been helping you.
Yeah, absolutely. So they've been helping us with stakeholder engagement. I mean, I can tell you the ambassadors for the African continent, the ambassador for the Middle East, the ambassador for Asia, and all of that, they've been absolutely instrumental in making sure and enabling stakeholder engagements with the Ministry of Communications, local countries, with the regulator, with some of the operators that are in fact in the countries today. In fact, you probably know this. I think when you build a cable, to put the cable in the ocean is probably the easier part. It's really, really the easier part, given our experience. What takes a long time, it's actually to get landing rights and permits to actually deploy the cable. Once you get that out of the way, it becomes now an engineering capability that you need. You're kind of faced with. You can now deploy cables as you feel. So, and we decided to prioritize that phase of the project over the last 12 months. Myself and some of my board members at SICOM have been really traveling the world. In fact, I'm almost becoming a platinum member of one of an airlines here in less than 12 months, Duncan, which is not a good thing if you think about it. It's not a good thing if you think about it, but it's all because of all the travels that I've been making to all of these countries, talking to the Ministry of Communication in those countries, talking to the regulators, talking to our partners and all of that, and future partners. And quite interesting, some of the countries, we thought we're going to land in one position. And when we speak to the countries, they say, no. Have you thought about landing in three places instead of landing in one? Can you land in three places? I mean, that's really quite pleasing to see that there are countries that need this demand. It's not something that we just woke up in the morning to say we're going to do and then you build and everything will follow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, Elfius, we're going to throw up a map on the screen now. And this shows the proposed routing for SICOM 2.0. It's the red line you can see in the map. Mm-hmm. And those who remember the original routing, or the routing of the original cable, which is still obviously in service, it ran from the north coast of KwaZulu-Natal up the east coast of Africa. There was then a branch, I think, from Kenya to India.
Yep.
And then connecting to systems in South Asia. And, of course, then it continued up through the Red Sea and on to, I think, Marseille in France is where the landing was originally. Now, if you look at this map, you can see that there's a new leg completely running across the Indian Ocean past Mauritius and Reunion. Are you going to connect those two islands as well?
Not at this stage. Not planned. But anything is possible because, I mean, right now we're thinking of that as a straight express route.
Okay.
From South Africa all the way to Singapore at this stage. We're not thinking of hopping into each of the countries. But as I mentioned earlier on, to say when you start talking to the ministries and you start talking to these countries, you actually have volunteers that come up and say, well, have you considered actually just having a stub that connects to us?
Right.
So I'm not going to say 100% no. Mm-hmm. There's a chance that we might end up connecting other areas. But at this stage, the thinking is we're going
to
have
an express
route there.
And what's the thinking behind that express route to Singapore?
Is that a bandwidth? But also, let me take a step back. In fact, if you look at that, the architecture of our cable, we thought about multiple things in terms of the design. In fact, in light of all the outages that we've had, I think you'll know this, last year we had a number of outages. When early February, we had our cable come down in the next to Yemeni waters, if you remember, in the Red Sea area. There were three cables that were cut around.
You remember
that time? Mm. Yeah, we were cut and we were down for quite some time. And then later on, I think it was around March, I think March or May, we also had another cables cut on the west coast of the continent.
That was a rock slide.
Correct. Mm. The only cable that was up at that point, it was Equiano. Mm-hmm. Luckily, we have capacity on Equiano, so we could reroute traffic down from Mombasa all the way down. And then obviously introduce higher latency, but at the end of the day, the communication was not completely broken, right? So we could do that. So that's that. The second part is we have to also think about diversity, route diversity. We need to think about making sure that we don't go through the same choke points. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at our region have got probably primarily three choke points. Mm-hmm. The one is the Bel Elmand Strait, which is Yemen, Djibouti.
That's into the Red Sea.
Into the Red Sea. You also have Oman, Iran, the Strait of Hormuz, mm-hmm. right? Also there. If you go down to Singapore, there's also another, I think, Strait of Malacca. There's also another choke point. Mm-hmm. So when you're now designing subsea infrastructure, you have to think about how do you make sure you create different diversity. So if one route goes down, it doesn't completely break down the communication of the world. So that's in the first important. The architecture follows that. Second is, we actually have to think about you don't have cables that are concentrated in one location. So if one cable landing section goes out and it's got eight landings, then which means communication is gone. So we need to think about how do we, if not landing, we don't land in the same cable landing station that two of the other cables are landing in a different one. So if that one goes down, we have that. And also then think about creating terrestrial links that will also provide kind of resilience when things like that happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the architecture is very, very different now. So it takes into account resilience, takes into account traffic growth in terms of international bandwidth, but more importantly, it's security and resilience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so obviously that's going to help with that route to the Far East and onto China and onto the cross-Pacific cable systems that run to the west coast of North America, which provide redundancy in the easterly direction to the current cable systems, which tend to run along the west coast and then up across the Atlantic to North America. But you're also extending this cable system around the south of South Africa, past Cape Town, and up to a landing station in Angola.
Lobito, yeah, correct.
Why that particular town in Angola?
Specifically, I think you might know that there's a big Lobito Corridor project that has been planned. It's been on the cards for quite some time, which is going to effectively facilitate the linkage of east to west of the continent. That's going to be a corridor that's going to facilitate a lot of global trade between Africa and the US and also Africa and the east as well. So, and that... it's called the Lobito Corridor. I mean, it's well written and it's well documented in the industry. You can go and look at that. We want to be strategically located to be able to carry communication from there. Because today there are also various landing points in Angola.
There's the SAX cable that Angola Cables constructed. Does that also land in that town, or is that somewhere else?
Somewhere else. Okay. So you're going to see at the coast of Angola, we'll probably have probably three or four landing stations.
Okay.
We will be the first one to land in Lobito.
Lobito.
Yeah.
Okay.
We obviously having communications and partnership discussions with Angola Cables, or one of our partners, and we'll look to enable that. And then that will now, all of a sudden, you now have Lobito. And that train line that's been built from Angola all the way to the east coast of the continent, all of a sudden you can deploy fiber
along
the train line. So you can actually now have connectivity east-west.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's the thinking. That's the future of the communications going.
Okay, and would you then be able to connect to some of the subsea cables that run along the west coast, like Equiano you mentioned earlier?
Equiano doesn't land there. I think there are plans that they're going to land, I think it's just around DRC.
Okay.
It lands further south, so we'll be able to obviously link it via terrestrial links and all of that, yeah.
I see, correct. But you'll be able to connect onto all of those systems, and potentially onto SAX as well, and... What are the other cables? Wax.
And
others that run.
And others. Two Africa is also coming through that line as well.
Of course. Yeah.
So, and I think all the design, Duncan, if you think about it, it's really ensuring that you do not have concentration of cables that carry strategic capacity and communication for the world landing in one area.
Yes.
So if one cable landing station goes, others are still there.
Yes.
And if you build terrestrial rules that come from one cable landing station to another one, it makes it easier. Also, you can also build what we call festoon, festoon technologies, where you don't have repeaters in between. So you basically move from one cable landing station to another. So it gives that redundancy. So if one cable landing station is gone, you can still have communication that goes out to the rest of the world.
Okay.
And that's the design thinking there. Yeah.
I want to focus on two more areas on this map. The first is the southern, or the coastline of South Africa. You currently only land at Mthunzini on the KwaZulu-Natal north coast. I take it Mthunzini will be one of the landing stations for the new cable, will it?
Yeah, we currently land there. The intention is to land there. And also, again, because some of the cables are now landing further north, which is at Amasimtoti. We land in Mthunzini, so we're going to continue to land there. But in South Africa, we're thinking about multiple places.
Yes, what are you looking at the moment? I see there are a few red dots here along the coastline.
Correct. So currently, the current planning is we think of landing in Mtunzini, where we land. We are considering landing between either Port Elizabeth or East London,
mm-hmm.
and then we go around, land in Cape Town.
Mm-hmm.
Cape Town probably between either Dinafontein or Isaacfontein,
mm-hmm.
or a complete new cable landing station. We're actually talking to one of our partners that we may be actually putting another complete new landing station that again increases diversity.
So this, and there are still suitable sites. They're
still suitable, just north of the existing landing, the last cable landing station, without mentioning its name.
Okay,
there's actually land available there. We just need to make sure there's power, there's all of that equipment.
So that would be north of Isaacfontein.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're thinking about that, but if we don't end up doing that, we're just going to land in one of those existing areas. So mm-hmm. in South Africa, then we're probably going to end up having 3 to 4 landing points.
Mm-hmm.
Which allows us to then have this diversity. So if one cable landing station gone, we can go to the other,
mm-hmm.
right? But more importantly is then our investment in terrestrial fiber that link all those cable landing stations to the main cities and mm-hmm. back again.
Mm-hmm.
We're also making that investment. I think you know, Duncan, a while back in 2018, we acquired a company called Fiberco.
Yes.
Fiberco is actually a wholly owned subsidiary of Sicom. We've been investing a lot of money. In fact, this year, we're investing in building, enhancing capacity on some of those routes. I mm-hmm. mean, we are on the majority of the motorways in South Africa. So we're increasing capacity there. And we believe this cable, it makes no sense to only have that termination capability at the cable landing station. It doesn't go into the city.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to also be doubling down our investment in that. Again, we do that in partnership. The nice thing about South Africa is there's a lot of fiber infrastructure that's going on the ground. So we don't need to build fiber where fiber has been built. We just need to do dark fiber agreements, and we light our own fiber and then make sure that mm-hmm. that connectivity goes from there to where it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Then traveling further up the East Coast, there are a few more red dots in places I recognize as existing Seacom landing stations, but it looks like you might be planning a few more in East Africa as well.
Yeah, correct. For instance, in Kenya, currently majority of the cable lands in Mombasa.
Mm-hmm.
There's another port north of Mombasa that we think of landing there. So we're considering that as well. We might not end up landing in Mombasa. We're going to go there. Again,
redundancy.
Cable landing redundancy and station redundancy and all of that stuff as well. I'd also mentioned earlier that if you go up, our cable, the current cable, if you pass the Bel Almand Strait, it's actually in the shallow waters a lot closer to the Yemen coastline.
Mm-hmm.
We are planning our cable to be a lot more closer to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And that part of the strait is actually a little bit deeper,
mm-hmm.
and we want our cable design is going to hug primarily the African coastline, a lot more towards Eritrea, all the way up into Sudan, from Sudan across into Jeddah. We may actually end up landing in 3 places in Saudi Arabia:
mm-hmm.
Neom, Jeddah, and another city down south, and then we're then going to go from there through Egypt via the Suez Canal into the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're going to do. But there in the Red Sea, the design is very different to our original design. So the previous cable was more towards the Middle East. Now this new cable is going to be a lot more closer to the African shorelines.
Interesting. I see that.
Yeah.
Is there anything you can do about the shipping traffic and anchors and all the problems that in the Red Sea? Is there any way you could route the cable there, maybe terrestrially for a distance to avoid the shipping yeah. and the anchors?
Now, you know, the reality is you I don't think you can really, but in fact, I was just at the submarine conference in Singapore.
Mm.
Last year, at the same event, we were talking about how do we create submarine resiliency? How do we make sure that we can prevent all of these unplanned outages happening? So now cables are now going to be manufactured. Certainly the cable that we're going to have will have sensors.
Mm-hmm.
Sensor technology that will be able to monitor marine activity above your cable. That will give you alert to say, well, actually there's activity above your cable that your cable might be cut. And not only that, if you take that data from your cable, you use GPS coordination data, you will be able now to pinpoint which ships, which boats, which trawlers have actually impacted the cable. So in the past, submarine cables didn't have any really real-time monitoring capability. Mm. I mean, it was passive devices that were there. Now you can actually have active devices that will be able to generate, call it monitoring and surveillance traffic that allows you to be able to monitor. Are you going to get rid of ships and all of that? That's always going to be there.
Mm.
But it's how do you strategically position the cable so that they're completely away from the high routes where the majority of the ships and trawlers kind of go through. Mm. I do foresee that that is not going to go away, Duncan. It's part of the business. Every now and then you're going to have a cable cuts. It is just that I think last year, if you look back, it was unprecedented. To have like three or four cuts in a year, it has never happened before.
Yeah.
So it basically, what it did though, it actually allowed the rest of the world to rethink how we actually plan submarine infrastructure. You may not know this. You know, people talk about cloud, for instance. And I always joke with people, they talk about cloud, they look up. A cloud is not up, it's actually in the ocean. Mm-hmm. The submarine cables today, we carry more than $10 trillion of transaction on daily basis. So if you think about that, if that infrastructure is not considered and not thought about from a resilience, from a security point of view, the whole world could come to a halt.
Mm-hmm.
Financial markets can come to a halt. So the design of submarine cables now, architecture is changing to make sure we deal with resilience, we deal with active monitoring of activity above the cables, and also just normal cable erosion. And more importantly, also to make sure that you deal with the potential cyber activities that might be in use.
There was a fascinating article, I think, in the FT or The Economist or one of those papers a week or two back that spoke about what might happen in the event that a third world war broke out and Russia was involved in hostilities against NATO and the Europeans. And the suggestion was that one of the first things Vladimir Putin could do would be to seek to sever the subsea cables that the Western alliance would rely on for communication ahead of those hostilities breaking out or in the early stages of those hostilities breaking out. And I think that just shows how important this stuff has become, not only to business, but to the way that humanity communicates. And and if there was a war, that this infrastructure is actually quite vulnerable potentially.
Mm. Duncan, I'm not equipped to talk about war and all the other things. What I can tell you is I think digital infrastructure is quite important for the global connectivity and all industry depend on it. If you were to disrupt digital infrastructure, whether submarine cable, terrestrial networks, the economies come to halt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just give you a good stats. When I mentioned earlier, our cable got cut. It was early last year, right? Around February.
That was because of the Houthi rebels who tried to sink a ship.
It was because of a cable anchor that cut a cable together with other two cables.
Yes.
Right? I mean, the ship.
It dragged its anchor.
Correct. There were countries that were shut down from the internet for several weeks. They couldn't even get a restoration capacity because, remember, there are countries today that connect to the world via another country, especially in Africa because we've got so much landlocked countries. So not all countries in Africa have got enjoy the coastline. So like, for instance, if you look at Lesotho, look at Uganda and all of those, they connect via other countries. So if you take out those infrastructure, you can't do balance of payments, you can't do settlements, you can't do all of that. You literally, the economy runs to a halt. So I think submarine infrastructure really has become strategic assets that not only us as cable operators have to worry about. Governments and forums, industry forums have to worry about creating and making sure those environment is secure because all of it depends on it. Without submarine cables, you won't have cloud. Without submarine cables, you won't have financial services. Without submarine cables, you won't have AI. I mean, AI today, I mean, we think about AI. When people talk about AI, they think about just the interface that we've got. But there's a whole lot of platform and architecture underneath that's supported by this infrastructure.
No, we're completely dependent on it.
Yeah, correct. So you are absolutely right. How will the wars be fought in the future?
Yeah.
Probably not only arms, but it could be communication infrastructures.
Your existing cable system, how many years of life is left in that, and do you start to decommission that once the new cable goes live, or do you still see it having years of life in it?
So on average, submarine cables would have a lifespan between 20-25. Others are stretching it out, probably 27-30.
Mm-hmm.
We think our cable has got a lifespan of about 25 years. We are on the 16th year now, which means
still a good decade ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the commercial models of capacity, either you do what we call indivisible rights of use, which is IRUs, or you do what I call multi-recurring contracts that you have with people. So now, when we launched the cable 16 years ago, we would sign IRUs that were 20 years or 25 years. Now you can't sign IRUs that are that long now. You can only sign maybe 10 years IRU and all of that. So we anticipate our cable we're gonna decommission it around 10 years or 9 years from now. We still believe there's still a lot, some headway to go on that. Hence the reason why we're planning SIGCOM 2.0 now.
Mm-hmm.
We will get to a point where SIGCOM 2.0 becomes live. We cut over clients from the existing cable to the new cable gradually. And other clients might choose to remain there mm-hmm. because the pricing model might be different.
Okay, it becomes cheaper.
It becomes cheaper to maybe to be on the older cable, mm-hmm. provided we keep it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was quite impressed when I was in Singapore last week. I met this company. It's an Australian company that they are actually manufacturing equipment that prolongs your cable's lifetime. Mm-hmm. So my CTO and I actually happened to talk to this company to say, actually, we're thinking about a cable being decommissioned in 10 years' time. We may give another 5 years. We might be able to, by just changing the cable connection points, mm-hmm. we might get probably another 5 years or 7 years out of the cable. But realistically, you're looking at about the maximum period of about 25 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, fascinating. Let's talk a bit about the financing around a project like this. This is obviously a huge investment you're making. I don't think you've disclosed the
expected. No, we haven't.
Mm. But we're talking hundreds of millions, if not billions of rand to deploy a cable system like this. What's the financing model you're looking at here? Are you going to be raising debt? Are you looking for equity, a combination of those two things, other financing models? What's your thinking?
No, actually, I mean, one of the things that maybe puts us in a very advantageous position, we've done this before.
Mm-hmm.
We know the models that work. We know the models that haven't worked. And we've also seen people make mistakes after we build our own cables. One thing we are very clear about, Duncan, we are not going to be part of a consortium. We do not believe in consortium cables. One of the biggest strategic advantage I have at SIGCOM is a privately owned cable. So decisions about what we do with the cable.
It's actually quite unusual to have a private.
It's very unusual, but it's a model that works. So to make a decision whether we're going to upgrade one link, maybe from South Africa to Mombasa, it's a decision that I make together with my team and my board. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have consortium cables, a single decision could take 6 months, 3 months, a year. So we're very clear about the model. This will be another privately owned cable by SIGCOM, operated by SIGCOM. Are we going to have partners? We are most likely going to have partners. Like the current SIGCOM 1.0, if you were to use that phrase, is we had a partner. One of our biggest partners on SIGCOM 1 was Tata.
Mm-hmm.
The link that we built from Dar, so we got a link from Dar all the way to Mumbai, and we got the same link that goes from Djibouti all the way to Mumbai. We did that together with Tata Communications. So in this new cable, there's opportunities to do exactly the same, but not taking away from the point that the cable remains privately owned by SIGCOM. That's a very important commercial structure that we never, ever want to lose that because it gives us competitive advantage in the market. We can do things that consortium cables are not able to do. So that, for me, it's important. So that is sacrosanct, if you put it that way. The second part about the funding model, we also got experience, right? Our original cable was also a combination of debt and equity. We are going to do exactly the same. We believe that, in fact, there's a huge appetite, Duncan, from both the DFCs and the development banks, the local banks in South Africa, local banks, development banks in Africa. There is huge interest for infrastructure financing that I think we're not going to have a shortage of people wanting to participate in this project, and also given the magnitude of it. And then early discussions that we've had with these organizations are quite excited. Some of them, without mentioning the names, expressing interest for both debt and equity.
Mm-hmm.
Others are saying we're happy to do debt. And others are saying we're just happy to be part of the project. Wherever you need us, we'll be able to do that. So very, very exciting. And I think also what maybe gives us an advantage here, Duncan, is we've proven the model.
Mm-hmm.
We've done it before when people thought maybe we're never going to do it. So I think there's faith and there's a proven track record. And these large development banks and finances know that SIGCOM is good for the money. We've been able to do that successfully.
And are your existing shareholders on board? I'm thinking of the likes of Remgro, Convergence Partners. Mm. Are they also on board for this investment?
You know, I'm quite lucky that it's not often that you see that the original shareholders of what has started as a project, if you go back. I mean, SIGCOM really started as a project in 2009, was to do that.
Mm-hmm.
All our shareholders are still in SIGCOM today.
Mm-hmm.
It tells you a number of things. One, they are happy to run the course. Secondly, they believe in the current and the future position of this organization. So I'm quite chuffed about that. And I think obviously it's going to be up to them as to whether they're going to be on the next wave of technology evolution.
Mm-hmm.
But what gives me comfort is SIGCOM 2.0 has been planned and is worked on given their mandate that are given to me and all of that. So I'm excited about that.
Okay. Before I let you go, let's talk a bit about the timelines around CECOM 2.0. Where are you in the process at the moment? I know there's a whole long list of things that any new submarine project has to go through, and one of those is doing a survey of the seabed. Another is appointing a contractor to lay the cable for you. Where are you in all of that process?
Duncan. I mean, these are projects, multi-year projects. Mm-hmm. We have managed to cover some ground. Let me just maybe put it in phases. So typically what you have what we call the planning phase. The planning phase is usually in entails, which is probably maybe the longest phase, which entails confirmation of landing areas, where you're going to be, landing rights, and all of that, where you're going to land, in which countries, and how you're going to land there. All of that takes a long time. Then you then do marine surveys. Mm-hmm. The good thing for us is we know the terrain. So we have got a historical data of marine survey of where cable currently goes. We need to do obviously updated ones. Once you've done that, you then confirm the exact routing undersea, mm-hmm. right? Because the seabed is very different, different terrains in different places. Once you do that, then you can start planning the cable design and the routing. And once the routing is done, then you can then start laying the cable. So we're looking at, we started our planning last year. So the regulatory engagements, the policy engagement, the cable landing station, partners engagements, all of that, largely about 90% of that is done, and which is primarily the biggest part of the work. So I'm quite comfortable that part of the process. I should probably conclude it within quarter one, quarter two next year. It should be out of the way. We are now at a point where, in fact, my CTO tells me by end of this week, we're going to be issuing RFPs to the industry about potential people that are going to be the people that will manufacture the cable, the people that are going to do marine surveys for us and all of that, the RFPs are going to be coming out. So we are in that stage. And then we anticipating building the cable late 2020, beginning of 2027, 2027-28, we'll build the cable and we'll go live definitely late 2029. If we are delayed for some reason, we're looking to go live quarter one of 2030. So we've got a good 5-year period to build it, and we believe that it's advisable. The second part of that is you can see our infrastructure and the cable spends roughly about 25,000 kilometers. We are most likely going to do it in phases. And we, at this stage, the planning is probably going to do it in three phases. The first phase will be Mediterranean down all the way to Djibouti, and then from Djibouti all the way to Fujairah in the UAE. That will be the first phase, kind of connecting that the Middle East and the Red Sea portion of the Indian Ocean basin, right? And the second phase will then be taking it from Djibouti all the way down to Lobito, which is the South African,
around
South Africa. And the last phase will then be this part around South Africa to Singapore, Singapore to then India, Pakistan, Pakistan back to the UAE. So it'll be multiple. So other phases will probably be ready way before that, and I think
we'll before 29 to 30.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Okay. So then we'll light as we, you know, with the, obviously the builder of cables, you are able to light other areas before others, other landing stations can be connected.
Right.
So that's the thinking.
Okay. So by end 2029, early 2030 at the latest,
correct,
the entire system will have been commissioned.
Correct. That's what we're looking at. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, that timing might change. I mean, it changes depending on a number of other factors.
Yes.
You might find that maybe your planning says you're going to land in this cable landing station, only to find that maybe there is, once you start doing the detailed work of surveys and all of that, you might decide to land in a different place, which means that might introduce delays.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly our planning is by 2030, we should be live.
Yes.
In fact, one of the reasons why we want to do that, I think you know that the Saudi Arabia is it's hosting the Soccer World Cup 2030.
Oh, yes.
We want to make sure that by the time they do that, we become also one of the strategic partners to carry that live football content out of Saudi Arabia to the rest of the world. So hence also that timeline.
Okay, fantastic stuff. Alpheus Mangale is a CEO of CECOM. Incredible project. Thank you for sharing all the details with Tech Central's audience today. It is much appreciated.
Duncan, thank you very much. Thank you for having me here.